OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 133 of Sign Language. This will be the last episode for 2013. Take a couple of weeks off over the Christmas and New Year period, and then come back at it sort of second or third week of January. I got another reply from Rob Bettler, who was quite impressed that I featured his email. He said, "Wow, you featured my email. Gosh, I feel like an American Idol contestant." Yet. Oh, come on. It was not that epic. Anyway, thank you for including my ramblings, sir. This time I will be concise. Promise. Okay, here are the points. No Lazarus building the pod? Agreed. Better dead than zombie. No YouTube? Okay, agreed. Green screen Bruce is not ready for prime time. The lights on and the makeup are expensive too. Linda Studios production quality truly spoiled you with quality, sir. Good spoiling though. Yep. I'll agree with that. About the bus analogy versus the Freakonomics upside of quitting. Bruce, I think you may have not realised, or I didn't make myself clear enough, you yourself are exercising both quitting and staying on the King bus by quitting photography and simultaneously staying on the bus of audio. I hope you can appreciate the meaning of you having your cake and eating it, you greedy bastard. About the rednecks, as with the ball of nickel, the sound of the tire was the trivia. Meaning, play one mysterious sound. Oh, this went on about Rob's idea of having a mystery sound in each episode. Anyway, about commercials. Maybe you may agree with me, but commercials also have the bad habit of being excessively loud versus the actual show. Drives me nuts. Loudness wars wannabes. Well, I'll just jump in there, Rob, and say that in America, in Europe, and in Australia, there is a government body in each of those regions which has now dictated that audio content has to be consistent on a, not always LKFS, but usually something that is very similar to LKFS. For those who are not familiar with LKFS, it is the L stands for loudness. The K stands for the K weighting system, which is named after Bob Katz, the mastering engineer who came up with the idea. And FS is full scale. Essentially, this is a progression on from RMS. I mean, RMS is much better at determining a consistent playback level as opposed to simply using a peak program meter, because as we know, peak program meters can be tricked quite easily. Things can peak a lot higher than their actual average sound level, and things that have been extraordinarily heavily compressed can sound really loud even when their peak level is quite low on a peak meter. So RMS is certainly a step forward. LKFS goes one step further by adding in algorithmically based level detection, which is frequency dependent, where RMS is broadband. LKFS kind of uses a weighting, in favor of those, well, not in favor of, but using the frequencies that where we are most sensitive, so that sort of, 3K to 6K range. So applying more weighting to those frequencies than, the regions outside of that. Here in Australia, I think the television standard is minus 24 dB LKFS. I think Europe and America might be minus 23, but it's around about the same kind of thing. And if you're thinking what I'm thinking, you're thinking 24 dB down, that's a lot of headroom. And jury's out for me. I don't know why they chose so much headroom. Maybe my man in Hollywood could weigh in and give me some idea as to why there was that much headroom allowed in the spec. But basically, the spec is there now in the three regions I mentioned, the US, Europe and Australia. And basically what happens is that everything has to conform to this loudness spec, and basically everyone in the broadcast industry has had to adopt new metering scenarios so that they can read LKFS and, you know, master their own content to minus 23 or minus 24, depending on which region it is. And the beauty of LKFS, or of the LKFS system, is that there is both a short-term and a long-term reading. I'm not sure of the exact timing allowances there, but I think short-term sort of works on the, you know, less than 1 second kind of idea, and long-term is sort of averaged out over 20 or 30 seconds or something like that. It's, yeah, I haven't read up fully on it, because in radio we are, believe it or not, actually not subjected to this LKFS thing yet. Hopefully at some point soon we will start to implement it, but it hasn't been dictated that radio has to, so it is a little outside my area of expertise right at this point in time, because I've not been exposed to it to a great extent, but I am across it a little bit. But to get back to your point about the commercials still sounding louder than the other content, the problem with this, and I don't think we're ever going to come up with a system that will get over this, is that commercials are always designed to be quite consistent in their level, in that, you know, as I demonstrated in the last episode, you know, when you do a commercial read, you tend to you push it out, and because there is dialogue going boom 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 all the way through it, it's quite consistent. Where with a TV show or a movie, you know, you have long pauses, and you know, there's a lot of variation in the way dialogue is delivered. And at the end of the day, it's all about dialogue, right? That's essentially what we want. We want a consistency of level with dialogue almost more than anything else. I won't say exclusively, but yeah. So anyway, it's a huge can of worms, Rob, and I agree with you. It would be fantastic if there was a way that, you know, we could get commercials to play back at a level that felt consistent with the program content that we'd just been watching prior to going to the ad break. I don't think we're there yet. I think there's a long way to go. Anyway, moving on with Rob's email. About the outdoor audio. Man, when I was listening to you, I kept cracking up and thinking of this horrible classic.
Come on. Come and say g'day. I'll slip an extra shrimp on the barbie for you. Come and say g'day.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Yes, I learned the lesson. Australians always say prawn and never shrimp. Yes, that is correct, Rob. We don't say shrimp. See? Concise. I thank you again for reading my ramblings. I'm very glad you and the Lazarus podcast are back. Crap. I just realized in that analogy, you are the father of the podcast. Please don't get a god complex, Bruce. We already have a Howard Stern. Regards, your bro, Rob Bettler. P.S. You meant epic as in OCD? No worries. I only go epic when the undead podcasts rise. Haha. PS2. This cracked me up. Honestly, I come in peace. All I want is gold and slaves. Christopher Columbus. Politically incorrect, but I love it. Something else that crossed my mind, or crossed my field of view through the last week or so, was a video that kind of went a little bit viral. It seemed to appear everywhere, but then maybe that's just because of the company I keep online. So some of you will have seen this, some of you may not have. It's an interesting exercise. Basically, these two guys created a video of one of the two of them playing a very, very, very basic drum kit. It's a, you know, kick drum and a snare, and maybe there was a hi-hat there, I can't remember now, in various locations. And they, you know, state at the beginning of the video that no artificial reverbs have been added, and it is simply a demonstration of how different environments can generate their own reverbs and, you know, acoustic reflections and delays and whatnot. Now, at first, I thought that there might have been a little bit of video trickery going on, because as it plays through this video, the first thing I noticed was the rug on which the drums were set up, and the position of the drums and the position of the drummer all appeared to be absolutely perfectly in the same position in every environment. And I thought, wow, hang on, something's going on here. If they just green screened all these different environments into the background, because I know what it's like trying to recreate positioning and, you know, focal length and distance and all that kind of stuff for different photos, and it is almost impossible to replicate that kind of thing. But then they had a bit of a behind the scenes which did show an alternate camera angle, so I don't know, jury's still out for me. They did show that the microphones that were on top of the DSLR were simply a spaced pair of mini shotguns, which kind of lends a little bit of credence to the idea that, you know, they were simply recording this guy playing the drums in each of the, you know, environments which are shown in the video, and that, you know, supposedly what you're hearing is the sound of each of those environments. But I don't know, it's just something about the way they got the placement of the drums and the carpet absolutely perfect from every different environment they filmed in. And on top of that, this guy, the drummer, is at exactly the same tempo every single time, almost as though he played the whole thing in one hit rather than, you know, recording in different times and places. Anyway, have a look at the video. The link will be in the show notes. I'd be keen to hear other people's thoughts on it. You know, if it has come to pass that it's been debunked since I saw it, please let me know. If it is genuine, then I take my hat off to the guys, because they did a hell of a good job. Like I said, if nothing else, in just getting the placement right from shot to shot, because it looks like, you know, it's all been shot in one sequence and then all these different environments were just green screened in. Anyway, yeah, keen to hear your thoughts. Now, what I wanted to talk about on this episode that I haven't covered on any of the other 130 episodes of this podcast is the idea of sidechaining. And I think probably the reason I never covered it was because it was not something I'd ever used. I'd never had a reason to use it in radio production. And I never got around to, you know, discovering a way of doing it with Audition, because I don't think Audition did it very well. Certainly not up to Audition Creative Suite 5, which was the last version of Audition that I touched. I don't know if they've introduced the ability to sidechain since then. But one thing I have discovered is that Reaper does it, and does it very well, simply because of Reaper's just amazing routing architecture that's built into the program by default. It's just gorgeous. Okay, so let's just step back a sec. What is sidechaining? For those who aren't familiar with the concept, or who may have heard the term but aren't familiar with what it is. Sometimes, and I guess the most common use of sidechaining is in contemporary music production. You might want to have a kick drum and a bass guitar, and, you know, it's not inconceivable that you would want the bass guitar to be fairly loud. And if you were EQing both the kick drum and the bass to both be sort of really sub, you know, harmonic heavy kind of thing, you know, lots of deep bass, then it's conceivable that the bass guitar will end up masking some of the kick drum. And the reason for that, even if the bass guitar player was, you know, slapping the bass, it's conceivable that those bass guitar notes will be shorter, will be longer in duration than the kick drum, which would mean that, you know, assuming the drummer's playing the kick drum on the one and the three, on the one and the three every time, the bass guitar is going to end up masking the kick drum. So the idea is that you would take one particular audio signal, in this case our kick drum, and you would send that signal via a send to the sidechain input of a compressor. And this can be done in the hardware world as well as in the software world. And what you would do is have the compressor itself acting on the bass guitar track, right? But the actual detection circuitry for the compressor is actually being triggered by the kick drum, right? So the idea is you would have a compressor with a really fast attack and a, you know, maybe a 50 millisecond release, and that would then force the compressor to clamp down really quickly on the bass guitar every time the kick drum was hit, right? And because of the, you know, fairly short release time, say 50 milliseconds, after the 50 milliseconds, the compressor lets up and then the bass guitar gets to swell up in amplitude, because by that stage, the, you know, the kick drum has kind of died off, because the kick is, you know, being a very transient type of sound. It's all sharp attack at the front and a short bit of woof after it that dies off, like I said, probably around about 50 milliseconds. Obviously, it's, you know, it's different for every drummer and drum, you know, and how it's mic'd and whatever, but generally maybe 50 to 80 milliseconds is going to be enough. And so you would have your release time on your compressor set to that, and that will allow the, you know, the kick drum to come through, because at the same time that the kick drum appears in our mix, that signal is also triggering the compressor on the bass guitar, so that it clamps down on the bass guitar, allows the kick drum to come through, and then, you know, that sort of 50 to 80 millisecond range, the compressor eases off and the remainder of the bass guitar note comes through. Now, like I said, in Reaper, this is quite simple to set up, and I won't go into massive detail on how to do it, but I will give you just a demonstration of what it sounds like. So, here's a drum track and a bass guitar track. I'll only give you a short sample of this. You don't need to hear, you know, minutes of it. And this is from a recent crowd audio project. So I'll give you a listen to it without any compression being applied to the bass guitar. So this is just the bass guitar and the drums playing together, no compression. Now, I've patched in a sidechain compressor and routed the kick drum signal to the input of the compressor, and just for stupidity's sake, I have set an extremely high compression ratio and quite a low threshold, so it's going to trigger excessively, but it will allow you to hear exactly what's happening with that sidechain input. You'll hear that the beginning of the bass notes are compressed very heavily, and then at the end of each drum sound, you can hear the bass guitar swell up. This is what it sounds like. Okay, like I said, very extreme, and you would never mix it like that, but you get the idea that you're using one signal to control a compressor, but that compressor is acting on another signal. Now, like I said, the idea of kick and bass is kind of the most commonly used scenario for sidechain compression. Probably the second most common use for it is to then use it for vocals and guitars. So, you know, in contemporary rock music and pop music, you want, you know, those guitars to be really screaming and loud in the mix, but you don't want them drowning out the vocal. So quite often what mix engineers will do is set up sidechain compressor across the guitar track and have a send coming from the vocal track, or the vocal submix, as the case may be. And so that vocal track is then triggering the compressor, which is acting across the guitars. So that allows you to have the, you know, the guitars quite loud in the mix, but by setting the compression, you know, to an appropriate level and an appropriate threshold, you can have those guitars just duck down every time there's a signal coming from the vocal. You know, so in other words, every time there's some vocal coming into the mix, the guitars will kind of duck down below that vocal. It's not something I've done a lot of. I'm just starting to experiment with it, and I'm really impressed with how Reaper is set up to, you know, just do this stuff so easily. It's just amazing. If anyone is using Reaper and would like, you know, me to explain how to do it, I'm more than happy to explain that to you. But yeah, so keen to hear if any of you have mucked around with sidechaining, and if you have used it extensively, if you've, you know, used it more than me, which is quite conceivable. Love to hear of any other scenarios in which you've used it, other than the two that I've mentioned. Yeah. Anyway, so that's sidechain compression. So I'm going to wrap this up for this year. Like I said, I'm going to take a couple, 2 or 3 weeks break over Christmas and New Year, and come back in the second or third week of January. I would like to say once again, thank you for all the support. It is good to be doing sign language again. I still don't quite feel like I've got back into my groove yet, but we'll get there. I would like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a safe and happy New Year. And until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotu.com.